It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, facial recognition software is being pitched to schools as a way to prevent mass shootings. We'll talk to a technology reporter about whether it's effective and the privacy concerns that come with it. First, 24 Wisconsin National Guard troops are being deployed to Arizona to offer support for border enforcement efforts. They're expected to arrive there by the end of the week. In April, President Trump instructed the Department of Defense to help the Department of Homeland Security in its efforts to secure the border with Mexico. Governor Walker said then that if a request came, he would send National Guard troops to help. U.S. Representative Mark Pocan called the president's move here political. Governor Walker rejected that.
This is not unprecedented, President. Both President Bush's and Barack Obama's president of the United States 8 years ago sent troops, sent National Guard troops down to the border because of drugs, because of criminal activities with illegal guns, with human trafficking, with threats that we have from those who want to come in as from terrorist states out there.
Meanwhile, this week's deployment comes as a backlash increases over a Trump administration policy that separates children from their parents at the border. Meg Jones is a general assignment reporter who specializes in military and veterans issues at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Meg, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob.
We'll talk about the role, the duties of these National Guard troops from Wisconsin going to Arizona.
Well, the 24 people that are heading out to Arizona from the Wisconsin National Guard, they come from all different units throughout the state and from a number of jobs. You know, everybody in the National Guard as well as the military has a specific job that they do. I don't know exactly what the jobs these people are coming from, whether they're drivers or whether they're military police or clerks. I'm not sure. But what they've been told, though, is that they'll find out their assignments, what they'll exactly be doing when they get out to Arizona. And it could range from a number of things. It could be logistics. It could be driving vehicles. It could just be a number of things that they're doing out there.
It seems like, for the most part, National Guard troops have been used in kind of a logistical or support role, not for direct enforcement. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Because, you know, if you think about it, the National Guard, they're all they're citizen soldiers. So they all they come from the civilian world, and many of them have jobs, you know, in the civilian world that they're adept at. And quite often those are the same jobs that they do in the National Guard, although not always. So it kind of makes sense to draw on National Guard soldiers because they have such a wide variety of work history and backgrounds and experience.
And do we know which part or parts of the state the National Guard troops from Wisconsin are coming from?
No, I don't know specifically, but I do know it's throughout Wisconsin that they're coming from. And by the way, they're all volunteers. So basically what happened is that after President Trump in April directed the Department of Defense to support the Department of Homeland Security efforts on the border, the National Guards in Arizona, California, New Mexico, and Texas then mobilized their National Guards, and this would have been under the militia clause of the Constitution. But those National Guards, they need reinforcements, and that's why the call went out to other states. And basically what happened here in Wisconsin is that as those requests came in, the National Guard put out a call, say, hey, we're looking for these skill sets. Does anybody want to go? And they could be deployed for a couple of weeks. I do know that the funding for this, by the way, Wisconsin taxpayers are not going to be paying for the wages of the Wisconsin National Guard units members in Arizona. but I know that funding for this particular call-up ends in the end of September. Now, they can renew that funding, or they can send those people back home to Wisconsin and their other states.
Talking to Meg Jones from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a group of Wisconsin National Guard troops headed to Arizona to assist in border enforcement. Meg, you covered a story some years back when there was a much larger deployment of Wisconsin National Guard troops, I think also to Arizona. Can you talk about that?
Sure, that's true. In 2006, George W. Bush had called up a lot of National Guards from all different states to go to the border for drug interdiction for criminals that were crossing over, and then also engineering units to build the wall down there. So I went down in February of 2007 and spent a week in Arizona, and I went out to I think 8 or 9 different spots where Wisconsin National Guard troops were working, and they're doing everything from, like I said, building the wall. I watched them as they were building these huge walls, engineering units. They were also doing like road paving, that kind of stuff to along the border. But then there were also back in 07, they did have some National Guard members that were helping the U.S. Border Patrol agents, with monitoring the border and then helping catch people. So this isn't the first time that Wisconsin National Guard troops have been sent to the border. I mean, actually, if you really want to go back, the entire Wisconsin National Guard in 1916, this is around 5,000 troops, they were sent down to Texas during the when the Pancho Villa raid was going on. So there has been a long history of Wisconsin National Guard members going down to the border for various assignments.
We're seeing stories around the country, Meg. A handful of governors have said they are either not going to send National Guard troops or they're withdrawing, in many cases, small numbers of their National Guard in protest, basically, of this child separation policy at the border. Are we hearing reaction in Wisconsin to what's going on?
Well, when I was working on a story last night, when I first heard that two dozen Wisconsin National Guard members were going down, I started seeing some reaction from local government officials that this was wrong, other states like Massachusetts and some of the other ones, and by the way, I think some of those governors are Republican governors. This
right.
isn't just a partisan thing. Refusing to commit their troops, even though, like say, Massachusetts had already committed sending a helicopter unit down there and some other troops, and then the governor said no. So I think what's happened is that back in April, when this originally came through, we didn't know, and this wasn't going on. It hadn't started yet where families were being separated. So it's become obviously much more of a volatile issue, and that's why you're seeing a lot of protests.
Was there that sort of political backlash back in 2006, 2007 when you were covering that much larger deployment?
No, none whatsoever. And I think it was because at that time, now granted, this in 06 and 07, this was only 4-5 years after 9/11, and both the Iraq and the Afghanistan wars were very, had a lot of troops going over there. So I'm wondering, Rob, if back then that people just were a little bit more concerned about safety, border safety, that kind of stuff, the threat to terrorism. Now, of course, it's a much different time. So it was framed back then in 07 for security reasons, and now it's framed in a much more different way, and so I think that's why you're getting much more backlash now. Back then in 06 and 07, it was just, let's beef up our security along the border to make sure that terrorists don't come in through that way.
Returning to the modern day, we've got these two dozen Wisconsin National Guard troops on their way there. Do we have any sense of how long this volunteer deployment will be?
Well, typically what they do is when National Guard troops get mobilized or get called up. And by the way, this is what they would call a Title 32 mobilization, meaning they're still under state control, meaning Governor Walker is still in charge of them, but also that their money comes through funding, as opposed to like a Title 10 mobilization where, like say during the Berlin crisis, where the president could go in and mobilize troops, and then they were under federal law or federal governing, which is also what happened during Iraq and Afghanistan when those troops got called up. But so the difference is now that when they volunteer, they don't know how long they're going to be gone. And that's kind of the nature of being in the National Guard. I heard that when folks were heading down to Puerto Rico and, you know, for hurricanes, for the hurricane work and stuff, they didn't know if they're going to be gone a couple of days, a couple of weeks, or even a couple of months. So these folks could be gone, like I said, through till the end of September, unless they renew the funds, and then they could be gone even longer. I do know in 2007, those folks that went down to the border were there for range in time from 2 weeks, and there were some that stayed 2 years at the Arizona border.
We'll leave it there for now. Meg, thanks for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
That's Meg Jones, a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who specializes in military and veterans issues. She joined us to share the latest on the deployment of 24 Wisconsin National Guard troops to Arizona to support border enforcement efforts. Right now, school safety is a big concern around the nation after high-profile shootings, with everything from more police officers to arming teachers being talked about. A high-technology solution is being marketed to schools, surveillance systems that use facial recognition software. Companies are marketing their software as a way to spot potential mass shooters before they attack, and many school districts are eager to get on board. But some people are voicing concerns over privacy and how well these systems actually work. Drew Harwell is a national technology reporter for The Washington Post, specializing in artificial intelligence and big data. Drew, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thank you.
Well, talk about these security systems, these facial recognition cameras. What do they do? How do they work?
Yeah, so face recognition is a technology we probably all know in our phones and sometimes at the airports. I mean, they effectively are able to use the software to match one face to another, but they're increasingly being used in these surveillance capacities where you can have a camera at a gate to let people in by scanning their face, or you can have one of these cameras that's in the ceiling of any supermarket or store you go into that can pick up not just that it is your face, but identify who you are, match to a database, or compare you against somebody on a blacklist. So it's an incredibly powerful system. The technology is progressing really rapidly. It's an incredibly cheap system now. You can get started for a surprisingly affordable amount of money to get a really powerful system. So you're seeing it in a lot more locations now. You're even seeing it in schools.
Now, if I'm a school board or a school district administrator, the companies that make these, they come to me. What are they selling me on? How would this work in a school setting?
They're selling them as security. They're pitching these as this, you know, amazing technology that can offer you something that no security guard can really be able to. This potentially accurate form of monitoring that can look out for the bad guy and alert the security when they see the face of somebody they don't want to see. And that's, you know, the companies are pitching this as a solution to school shootings. This is a time where every school is really nervous about becoming the next statistic. And these software companies are suggesting they have the answer through this technology that's very new. It's very gee whiz and incredibly affordable. So, you know, they're able to market directly to these administrators who are looking exactly for the thing they're suggesting they can do.
So this is in place. I walk in the front door, say at my kid's school, I get scanned. How does it know who's a bad guy? What's the database or the file that says, oh, yeah, this is a face of somebody we don't want here?
Yeah, every school is able to build their own blacklist. And for a lot of them, they have taken pictures of registered sex offenders, people who are have a warrant out for their arrest, fugitives, that kind of thing. But the schools can also put in whichever photos they want. So a lot of the schools have put in photos of students who have been expelled and are no longer welcome on campus, parents who may be in a contentious custody battle over who can keep the kid most of the week. And, you know, it really remains up to the administrators and the security on the school-by-school basis of who they want to allow on school grounds. So, you know, that creates all these questions of, will the schools begin to profile kids that maybe aren't bad but could be seen as potentially, you know, providing a hazard somewhere down the road? You know, it's one of these cases where no one wants a school shooter on campus, but it's really hard to know who that's going to be. You know, unless these systems can really preemptively identify who's going to be dangerous, they're kind of guaranteed to be ineffective because they can only look for the people you have sort of put on the blacklist. So they have the blacklist that they can look for, and then some schools operate off a whitelist where they just put in the photos of the students they want to allow on campus, certain employees, certain teachers, certain parents. And then if you're not on that list, it will trigger security and flag the school that there's a potential hazard at the gate.
We'll look a little more at potential concerns about this, but in looking at this, you found at least some school district administrators are on board. They're excited about this potential.
Yeah, I mean, they see this as potentially the next level of metal detectors or the next generation of having school security at the door. You know, this is an incredibly contentious debate now when we're talking about should we give teachers guns, should we amp up surveillance or checks of kids. And this technology presents that sort of air of science fiction almost. It seems futuristic. It seems like a software that can dispel a lot of these concerns and a lot of these anxieties from parents and school officials. And, you know, it's something that can run on its own. Faces are seen by police as this incredible asset in that you can identify people from far away. You don't necessarily need to get their consent like you would with a fingerprint. And face is fairly unique. It can be a pretty strong identifier. So a lot of the schools are going along with what the companies are saying and suggesting maybe it's something we try. Maybe it's the secret we need to protect our campus and protect our kids.
Talking to Drew Harwell from the Washington Post. He's a technology reporter there. He's written about the use of these facial recognition surveillance system in schools. Drew, let's get to some of the concerns now. One thing, these systems are sold as being able to tell your face from my face, from a high school kid's face, from a potential shooter's face. Do they work? Are they really good at identifying faces as unique and belonging to who they belong to?
Yeah, face recognition is still extremely new. It's very much untested. It works really well in certain situations and surprisingly poorly in others. It has different levels of accuracy, even varying by gender and skin color of who it's looking at. Face recognition cameras do way better with white guys than they do with women or people of color. And a lot of that has to do with the data that the systems are trained on. You know, there's certain algorithmic biases that get baked into these systems because they're dependent on lots and lots of data to teach them the differences between one face and the other, what one nose looks like versus versus mouth and eyes and face shape and that kind of thing. So they're not consistently accurate in a way that you would probably expect. When you're sort of using your face to unlock your phone, it's a little bit different. But when you're using a system like this to look at 20 people in a room or compare them against the 300 million faces that are in the U.S., it becomes a much more inaccurate thing. And face recognition is practiced even by the FBI, even in these broad-scale security models, is surprisingly inaccurate in a lot of ways. Even the FBI system is not close to, 99% accurate. So that's one big issue is precision. If these systems are going to be put in the gates of a school where elementary grade students are going in, and this system is deciding the difference between a student who's allowed in safely and normally versus a student who may be a red flag, may be a danger, may even be a school shooter, every little bit of inaccuracy counts. So that's one big concern.
The other concern I was going to say is privacy. People have raised the issue of, okay, you've got this unique recognizing image of my kid, say, and maybe it's linked with other information at the school. Who controls that information? Can you talk about some of those concerns?
Yeah. I mean, privacy is a huge one because these are our faces. And, you know, we have certain laws in the country that protect kids' privacy specifically. We've always sort of regarded kids' data as a little bit special because they're not able to consent in the same way that adults are. And this is adding this extra element of surprisingly invasive surveillance technology into this place where, you know, has always been sort of seen as, you know, a place of learning, a place where kids can grow and make mistakes and that kind of thing. So the privacy is a big one. I mean, even, you know, people who are out in a public place, they may expect that they're being videotaped, but knowing that they're being identified and matched to a database just because they're in public and just because the camera can see their face, I think that, you know, weirds people out a little bit. It's a whole new level of privacy and security that we're having to engage with. So we're dealing with that on the adult side of it, but now that kids are being sort of thrust into this debate and the question is over, who controls these images of kids' faces? What can these companies do with these images? How can they use them long-term? Some of the companies are using these facial images to train the systems that they're building long-term. They're sort of ingesting lots of facial data into these massive databases that they then train the software to understand. So is every parent okay with having their kid's facial image used in that way? Are the parents even asked? I mean, is this even something that we should be broaching with the parents first because it's their kid in the first place? All of these are unanswered questions. And the people who are leading the discussion right now are the companies making the software. And so the parents we've talked to and even some of the school administrators say, we need to slow down and confront these issues because right now we're just taking a lot of images of kids' faces and doing who knows what with them.
We'll leave it there. Drew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Drew Harwell is a national technology reporter for The Washington Post. He talked with us about the rise in companies marketing facial recognition software to schools as a security measure. First, after the rise of the Me Too movement and stories of sexual assault on college campuses, there's been renewed attention to the issue of consent. A recent project at the New York Times wanted to take a closer look at what they call the gray zone, stories that might not meet legal definitions of sexual assault or rape, but also didn't fit a clear definition of consent. College students shared their stories in a piece titled 45 Stories of Sex and Consent on Campus. Daniel Jones is the editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, and he was one of the editors of the project. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Good to be here.
Well, talk about why you set out on this project.
Well, I mean, there was a lot happening that interested us, but in particular the stories, you know, after the real explosive stories of Me Too that were sort of obviously sexual assault and people were losing their jobs and more subtle stories started to come out, and among those were like the story of Aziz Ansari that was exposed in babe.net, where a woman wrote about her encounter with him, and there was a New Yorker fiction story around this time called Cat Person that was also about a bad sexual experience, and both Jessica and I were fascinated by the conversation around those stories and this sense of different people blaming different parties for different behavior, and there didn't seem to be this sort of clean take on those experiences. And, you know, that's been called this sort of gray area of consent, and we knew that college campuses are where this conversation is sort of particularly relevant and particularly powerful because that's where you know, students are often having sexual experiences for the first time or having multiple sexual experiences and wandering into this. And we wanted to find out what they were saying.
And you reached out, you put the word out to college students, hey, we want your story. What in particular, how did you pitch this to them to get the kind of stories you were hoping to hear?
Yeah, we spent a lot of time on that because we wanted to be careful. You can tap into you know, a lot of sort of obvious, dark, bad experiences that are rape, and and much more that are much more black and white. So we just crafted this this ask basically that said, you know, what's an experience that you think back on that confused you and left you feeling unsettled. But it's not like you were full of blame. You were more like, how can I avoid being in that kind of a situation in the future? And we were really so gratified with the result. The students did, let me say this. They approached it in two ways. A lot of them wrote about an experience that most people would consider this sort of, you know, shift, an area of vague blame of who, you know, it wasn't clear who was acting badly or who was responsible for what. And that's one kind of gray zone experience. The other kind that more surprised us were stories that were more clearly sexual assault or rape, but the person wanted them to be, didn't want them to be that and didn't want to call them that, so had sort of tried to pull them back into this confused area by normalizing it and by saying, well, that wasn't, a friend doesn't rape you, right? And trying to take an experience that was not mild or gray or blameless and make it that, just to make themselves feel like they hadn't had a bad experience.
It seems there's a common or a lot of common themes, it seems like, but one of them is somebody coming away knowing that there was an experience that wasn't good, wasn't what they wanted, and trying to figure out what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are powerful emotional and physical experiences, and I think they take a lot of sorting out afterward. And, you know, for better or worse, men and women fall into these roles. If it's a heterosexual relationship, And we did hear from plenty of students who are in other kinds of relationships, but in the more common heterosexual relationship, you know, men, for whatever reason, feel like they need to push, and women, for whatever reason, feel like they need to be the arbiter of whether this should proceed or not. And those roles are so ingrained in us that they're hard to break out of. And women in particular felt exhausted by that equation. They just felt exhausted by this sense that all consent was basically on them to say no, 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 no. You know, even now in 2018, that still seems to be the dynamic.
Talking to Daniel Jones from the New York Times about a project there, 45 Stories of Sex and Consent on Campus. Daniel, can you give us a little more sense of the stories that you heard and the range of people you heard from?
Yeah, well, the most common theme that really sort of bowled us over was there are a lot of varieties of this, but it was women consenting when they didn't want to, and you know the men were asking, they were trying to move the encounter forward into the physical realm through. You know, just through hints and by just trying to work it that way in whatever way they could, and the women would consent. They would say no, or they would act like they didn't want to do it and act disinterested, and ultimately they would say it's fine, or they would say yes,
but not necessarily because they wanted to get it.
The stories we heard, they didn't, again, this has to in part to do with what we asked for, what kind of stories we were asking for, but so it's not a true sample of what's going on out there, but of this kind of behavior, it was women saying yes over and over and over again when they didn't want to. They didn't want to have sex, but they felt like they'd gotten themselves into the situation. They felt like they didn't want to be polite. One of the most interesting was they didn't want to be talked about. It was a reputational thing. They didn't want the men to talk about them afterwards as someone who was a prude and who sort of was a tease and a prude. They feared that more than they feared having a reputation of sleeping with someone on the first night or the first date. And that, you know, we've heard a lot of these kinds of stories over the years, or we feel like we're familiar, both Jessica and I, with this this kind of experience with college students, and that still surprised us that it was that was so common and that there were so many varieties of women consenting when they didn't want to.
And a common theme that I came across, these are not easy reads necessarily, but a common theme was often men maneuvering toward a situation where there is alcohol, intoxication, they're in a room alone with the woman, and then the border pushing starts.
Well, alcohol was so pervasive in these stories when we were reading them, and there were hundreds of them. You know, we narrowed them down to these 45. But I think the word blackout appeared more than any other you know, word that it was. And again, this is all, you know, it's wrapped up in the college experience, but it's also it sort of speaks to how uncomfortable it is to navigate, you know, physical intimacy in college, and that you want to take away your decision making almost, like you're drinking so that you don't have to be burdened with consent and you don't have to be burdened with decision making, and things maybe can just happen. But that led to a lot of I'd even say the majority of the stories we received had alcohol as a component.
And another common theme, in many cases, women, in a couple cases, men, for that matter, wanted to say no, and they didn't have the, in some cases, they didn't have the vocabulary or the etiquette, if I can use kind of a trivial word, or they worried about consequences, whether it's reputation, as you were talking about, whether it was, I mean, in some cases, a hint that, hey, maybe there's violence if I don't ultimately consent. We don't have that language for no, even apart from using the word no again and again, as many of the people did.
Yeah. You know, one woman had written, I had learned how to perform oral sex, but not how to say no to performing it. and that's pretty revealing about sort of sex education in America and how we learn about physical intimacy. Many of them were uncomfortable with having that conversation. And many adults people who are older are uncomfortable with that conversation too. We feel like sex ought to be natural, and that the instincts and the subtle cues that we give off and the sort of physical cues that we give off ought to do that work for us. And that you can, there was even a fear that was revealed in some of these essays that that you can talk the romance out of sex, you know, that you can, if you talk about it, it's going to sort of take away the magic and the natural quality to it. At the same time, there are too many bad experiences that are resulting from people thinking consent should be something that doesn't have to be spoken.
We're talking to Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column from the New York Times, co-editor of a recent project focused on sex and consent on campus. It's called 45 Stories of Sex and Consent on Campus. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a student in college yourself or a college-age person? Do these stories sound familiar to you? Are you trying to navigate this landscape? Do you come away from situations feeling confused about what consent was, what just happened? And we'll get to another question that this project asked students. What do you wish you could tell yourself when you were 15? What do you wish you could go back and ask? What do you wish you knew when you were a teenager going into these situations? As a parent, what do you hope your kids know? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Daniel Jones from the New York Times, talking about a recent project looking at sex and consent on college campuses. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a parent trying to figure out how to teach your kid about consent? Are you a college student? Were you recently? What kind of things did you encounter? And if you work at a university on a campus, what conversations are happening on your campus about consent? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. To our callers, Jenna is with us in Milwaukee. Jenna, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm happy to be here.
What did you want to tell us about, Jenna?
Yeah, I wanted a couple things. First of all, I just wanted to share that thank you for sharing this story. This is my life story. Like, I have lived this in my college years and even after, when I was like had graduated but had so many traumatic experiences, I still didn't feel I had the education or like wherewithal to speak my truth and claim my own space and say what I needed. There's two other things I wanted to say really quickly, and then I'll take my other reflections off the air. One thing was, I believe the man who's being interviewed had spoken earlier about the magic being taken out of sex with consent, and like, nope, I can tell you, I am really happily married to a man who treats me wonderfully, and consent is a really important part of our relationship, and like, yeah, there's still a lot of magic there. So that, and then finally, I'm really happy to see that this conversation is being had by men. Thank you for being two men who are willing to talk about this.
Jetta, thank you so much for sharing your story. Happy that things came out well for you there. With that issue of consent being sexy or taking the romance out, Daniel, that's something you heard from some people. It's not what you heard from everybody among the college students you talked to, right?
No. I mean, there's a very real variety of response to that. But one woman was... she was with a guy who could not have been more careful as they became intimate for the first time. And at each point, he said, "And can I unbutton your shirt? And do you mind if I put my hand here?" And she actually said, "Can you stop asking me? Can you?" She was put off by him being that careful, which, you know, is kind of sad in a way, because you're like, well, what is the answer if? If being careful is somehow unsexy or ruins the moment, or at least it did in this case. And then the woman sort of pulled back and she was like, well, I should appreciate him acting this way. But, you know, again, we're in these roles where when people break out of the roles, there's a bit of a disconnect. You know, there can be a bit of a disconnect and you're not quite sure how to proceed or how you feel about it.
Jenna, thanks so much for calling in and sharing your story. You had asked one of the categories of comments you got in this piece from college students, Daniel, was stuff people wish they'd known at age 15 before, say, they went off to college. What kind of things did you hear?
Well, I mean, the main thing I remember from that is just sort of having the agency to, what the caller just said, to speak about what you want instead of what the other person expects of you, that you're an equal participant in this, and that you can stop it at any point. There's no contract where if you go with a man to his room that says you have to follow through with anything, at any point you can stop and say, no, I'm not comfortable with this, and let's either take this up at another time or never again. But all of that is within your control. You know, the vast majority of these stories had nothing to do with people physically forcing themselves on someone else. It was all about this sort of subtle negotiation that would lead, you know, in most cases with women saying, okay, you know, let's just do it. I feel like I put myself in this position. And There were all those sorts of rationalizations and feeling like the men deserved it somehow. So the real lesson, I think, for a lot of the women in particular after was I'm allowed to say no. I'm allowed to stop this. I'm allowed to say let's not do this tonight, but maybe some other time.
Let's bring on another caller now. Mary is with us in Oshkosh. Mary, hi.
Hi. So I just heard he talking about how girls do not really want to accept the fact that their boyfriends or their friends did something to them, and they're just in denial. And it's just something that really spoke to me, and I wanted to say thank you for discussing something like this, because it really made me understand how some women feel about, you know, their friends or their boyfriends sexually assaulting them or raping them and not wanting to accept the fact that they were hurt.
Mary, thank you so much for that call. And this is something that some of your commenters in this piece, Daniel, were wrestling with, as you said earlier. Is this a transgression given my relationship mm-hmm. with the person?
Yeah, there were some really fascinating stories along those lines where women, in one case, a man really assaulted this woman. He didn't. She'd said no, and he just sort of pressed ahead, and they had sex. And she really thought afterwards, well, you know, a friend can't rape you, right? Like, this is someone who I know, who I've been in classes with. He's a friendly, you know, she considered him a good guy. And so to normalize that experience, she said, well, let's have sex again in the morning. And it was so strange to see that impulse of, let's have normal sex, which will make the sex that was, in effect, rape, okay. If we have sex under normal, undrunk circumstances where I am consenting, she was thinking that could somehow retroactively undo the act that happened before. And those are those impulses that, you know, after a sexual assault, going out to breakfast with the guy, because if you can keep things friendly and you can keep things normal, and maybe, you know, one woman said, well, we were probably going to have sex anyway if we continued to go out. So, you know, I guess it's okay that we had it, even though I didn't want it the first time. There's a real impulse to just make it okay and make it a confusing experience rather than an illegal one.
We just have a couple minutes left, Daniel, and I want to talk about what you heard from men who, in some cases, were replaying their own history and wondering, did I cross a line?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about that because, you know, we were so glad to hear from men. We were glad to hear from anyone on this project because it's such private material that, you know, to expose it and to have it appear in the newspaper, we just thought, oh, God, I hope people will really be honest and tell their stories. But in particular, we thought it would be challenging to hear from men. And a lot of the men we heard from said, like, I didn't, particularly with the Aziz Ansari story, they saw themselves in that behavior of that just sort of pushing and trying, you know, feeling like it was on them to be the aggressor and that men are supposed to be assertive and men are supposed to be experienced and lead the way. And that's sort of a lot of pressure on the man, especially if he's not experienced and he's not assertive and they feel they have to act that way. And it was sort of refreshing to hear these men say, like, maybe we shouldn't act that way, you know, and seeing it in other people's stories. You can talk about sex and consent in theory and according to rules and slogans as much as you want. But until you recognize yourself in other stories and see how those stories play out and think, well maybe that woman was uncomfortable. Maybe I shouldn't act that way next time. We heard a lot of that, and I think if things are going to change for the better, and I hope they do, that's the path forward. Seeing yourself in these stories and saying, and pulling back and trying to sort of reframe your next encounter and not act that way.
Very briefly, Daniel, do you have a next step in your coverage of this issue?
We don't. We very much wanted to gather that material and see where it led and see what sort of conversation it started. What we're hopeful about with the project, because it came out at the end of the school year, and there's some evidence that this is going to happen, which makes us feel good, is that you know, we know schools have workshops and orientations around sex and consent on campus at the start of the school year. And we're hopeful that this conversation will restart using this material at the beginning of the school year when freshmen are going off to college.
And we'll leave it there for now. Thanks to Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times. He was with us to talk about a project he co-edited. It's called 45 Stories of Sex and Consent on Campus. Deep-fried lasagna bites, turducken on a stick. If you see this kind of food around you, you know you're dreaming or you're at the state fair. The Wisconsin State Fair released the list of finalists for the Sporky Awards, celebrating unique and unusual fair foods. We have the list. Dean Kinetter, producer for Central Time, what are you liking on the list?
Well, despite not being a bacon acolyte, one that really stuck out to me was the pig candy cannoli. This is bacon strips formed into a cannoli-type shell. You got cheese, a
candied
cream cheese
bacon
mascarpone,
shell, yeah,
and then candied bacon bits inside there with the cheese.
I like bacon fine. This sounds like same. Like too much. I like a good cannoli. I'm kind of a purist. I think there's a little too much of the bacon in it. I don't know. I haven't tried it, obviously.
I understand your viewpoint, Rob. But what do you like? What do you like on the list?
Well, I'm very curious about the French onion soup on a stick. I'm always puzzled by the, you know, there was butter on a stick a couple mm-hmm. years back, how they take this liquid substance, basically, what's like air, you know, deep fried air on a stick. I don't know. So somehow they've taken the essence of French onion soup, batter fried it, I guess, and put it
onions and
stick.
Cheese and
yeah, but it's great flavors.
Crouton, yeah,
great flavors. What else is on there?
The fried turducken on a stick. That sounded pretty good.
Right,
you
that's
have
the
gravy
turkey,
and
chicken,
cranberry
duck.
Sauce on there.
Yeah, that's. Do you dip it? I didn't see that in the cranberry sauce.
I think
sauce.
They just drizzle it right on there for you. It's low maintenance.
All right. Well, we know what we're having for lunch in August. Dean, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is Central Time. Getting hungry on the Ideas Network.